Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing in-depth investigative reporting series on Gulf War Syndrome. We've done many programs in this series because there are currently approximately 700,000 individuals who served in the Gulf who believe that they are at risk of developing illnesses associated with their combat or pre-combat with inoculations, exposure to depleted uranium, the pesticide DEET that was used, the environmental toxicity from the oil well fires, and some of the experimental vaccines, including the anthrax and botulism. Unfortunately, up to this point, the official position is that these are not legitimate conditions. Instead, they have been told that they are suffering from a form of post-traumatic syndrome, and that as such, that they're not going to be covered once they're out of the active service. So when you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you're on your own. I have interviewed hundreds of these vets, and what's of interest is that they were totally healthy before they went in and volunteered for their service. Today they're not, and they haven't been, including some who never even got over there, who were sick before they got over. Now, how can you have post-traumatic stress disorder if you never served in combat? And those that did, many of them served a very short time. We have a lot of information today concerning some of the abnormalities that we see in their blood, in their brains, nervous system, versus a person not exposed to those different environments. I believe that with the efforts of many individuals, including some of my guests today, that there may be a shift, maybe a subtle shift, but a shift on the Department of Defense and Office of Veterans Affairs to finally start to pay attention. It's only when you continue to announce yourself that this is something that you're suffering from, do they pay attention. I believe that that's the case. Let's talk with my first guest about this. He is a medical doctor. He's done residencies in neurology and adult and child psychiatry. In addition, he has done fellowships in clinical neurophysiology and studied neurotoxicology. He was called on by the Army Surgeon General's office to help Gulf War vets. He is now working to help Armed Forces physicians better understand Gulf War illness and has presented his findings to Congress and the National Academy of Sciences and the National Gulf War Resource Center. His name is Dr. William Baumswager. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Baumswager.
Good afternoon.
Originally, you were called on by the military to help them understand the root problems that the Gulf War vets were experiencing before and during the Gulf War. Since then, you've noticed that members of the government seem to be divided on where they stand on Gulf War issue. On the one hand, they've invested an enormous amount of time and money into researching Gulf War syndrome. Yet, when you began working with the military, there was, I believe, some resistance. Now, I would like to see whether or not you feel that there is a shift and whether the military is able to take a more objective view of the conditions and really get in to start to help the vets. What's your perspective on this, please?
I believe that we have a very divided government internally on this matter. The reason I can say this is that my personal experiences have been dramatically different in terms of the way they've dealt with me and in terms of what's going on now. They seem to not even trust each other. The, you know, various branches of the government. We just found a wiretap in my telephone system yesterday. And clearly, you know, they're listening to each other to try and figure out what one another is doing within the government. And it's obviously a very deeply held and deeply felt issue where, you know, some people are, as a matter of patriotism, very much against the whole idea that red-blooded American boys can get sick from things you can't see. It's almost like pre-germ theories, ideas, you know, of illness. And then there's another group which is very concerned that we have created some kind of a scientific monster that has revisited us and is wreaking all kinds of havoc. The kind of thing you see in science fiction movies where, you know, the mad scientist creates something which just turns on civilization. It's almost as if this kind of a dramatic scenario is being played out in the minds of the people who are in the various agencies of the government.
In the interim, however, we still have a problem. The problem is that nearly 200,000 individuals have registered that they have suffered, and we still get back to this basic point. What are they suffering from? Now, having a background in both psychiatry and neurology, you're able to distinguish between neurological damage and post-traumatic stress disorder. What evidence do we have that the vets are not experiencing psychosomatic symptoms associated with post-traumatic stress disorder? And what evidence do we have that they are exposed to neurological toxins?
There is overwhelming evidence that this is a neurological, immunological, and a metabolic disease. There's evidence that it is associated with damage to the small arteries in the parts of the body which tolerate a lot of physical stress, for instance, the jaws, the hips, the knees, the ankles, and that the bone is breaking down in these areas. There's a great deal of evidence that we have reactivation of viruses, perhaps new viruses, that we're acquiring new funguses. And that all this is leading to a rapidity of aging. All this is leading to a breakdown in the very basic mechanisms which control the acid-base balance, which control the salt balance in the body. And without control over these mechanisms, we're going to get very sick. If we have Gulf War syndrome, we're going to get very, very, very fatigued, and we're not going to be able to function in society. So there's tremendous evidence that this is a physiological condition. In post-traumatic stress disorder, you do not have, except for some subtle, maybe deep brain problems, you do not have any of these physiological abnormalities.
Doctor, what I'd like to do, we don't seem to have a good technical connection. I'd like for you to hang up, and I'm going to try you right back again, see if we can't get a clearer line, all right?
Well, let me try a clearer line here. Hold on a second. I'm going to go over to this other phone.
Are you on a cordless phone?
Yeah, I'm on a cordless.
That's never good. You
That's
see,
never good.
That creates post-traumatic stress syndrome for broadcasters, not
us. Yes, okay. Well, hang on a second. How's this?
That's about 100 times better.
Okay.
Good. All right, now, let's again, so the public is aware, When I was in Washington recently and filming, because I'm doing a new documentary on Gulf War Syndrome, the old issue was these people, according to every major committee and every finding that has been at least official, even though there have been dissenting views, is post-traumatic stress syndrome. And yet the vets will say, well, I've never heard of someone having a rare cancer that's only in Gulf War vets. It wasn't in Vietnam vets. It wasn't in Korean vets. It wasn't in World War II vets. They were in wars. They were in wars a lot longer than we were. You know, we weren't over in the European theater, the Pacific theater, for 4 years. You know, some of these guys never even got off the ship. They never landed over there. They were on the ship, but they were still exposed. They were exposed to the inoculations, exposed to some of the biologicals that were in the air. How could it be that it's post-traumatic? And a lot of these people say they weren't stressed. They weren't stressed. You know, it was a job, and, you know, and they did it. And yet the officials just didn't want to believe them, as if their opinion didn't count. So let's try to distinguish the difference between what you could get from a post-traumatic stress disorder and what you realistically could not get, so we can see the difference between the two.
Yeah. Well, I think if we take a step back even further and talk about disease categories versus disease process, we can get a clearer view. The last report of the Institute of Medicine, which came out late last year about this, said that, in fact, the problems that these patients were having were hard to define in disease categories, and therefore they couldn't be really said to have specific diseases. And they said, well, next time we'll just have to do a better job. That was their view. However, if you look at the, instead of the disease entities, if you look at the disease processes, what's going on a cellular level, what kind of chemical changes are there, what are the are there changes in the metabolism? Are there changes in the number of or type of bacteria or fungi or other natural and unnatural microbes in the body? Are there changes in the density of neurons in the brain? You know, are there changes in all, you know, the bone, in the bony structure? Are there changes, as I said, in calcium and in acidity and base content of the metabolism of the body? If you look at it from that point of view, the point of view of not illness entities, but pathophysiological, we could call it, entities, then you see all kinds of illness. Now, post-traumatic stress syndrome is, in many ways, a non-entity, in a sense that that there may actually be neurological changes, but they're very, very, very subtle. And the signs and symptoms can't be explained by actual physical gross level findings. And that's why they're calling it post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's because they don't know what else to do with it. However, if you try and just understand what's happening in those areas that I mentioned, you can begin to really approach this thing and begin to make some headway. The fact is that this is a man-made disease. We created this disease. We did this to ourselves. And now I'm saying, when I say we, I'm not saying the United States. I'm not faulting the U.S. government. I'm not faulting the military. Certainly I'm not. This is an extraordinarily complicated problem. And how it came about exactly, I don't believe anybody understands or knows. I don't believe for a minute the United States, as a country, had anything to do with this. I don't believe that this is a deliberate thing, or some kind of euthanasia to get rid of people
who are
undesirable.
I believe most people would certainly accept that.
Yeah.
Let's go on to something that I think is important. Describe the symptoms that you see in Gulf War vets and explain how the health of the families of Gulf War vets is affected.
Well, Gulf War veterans have a very stable and classic presentation, in fact. And it's headaches, light bothering the eyes, tremendous fatigue, tremendous pain, especially in the joints, back, extremities. There's enormous fatigue associated with this. And there's not only all that, they do have psychological, quote-unquote, signs and symptoms. These signs and symptoms, however, weren't there prior to the Gulf War, and very much like the cancers and things you were alluding to before, these people weren't psychologically unfit. As a matter of fact, you know, they all passed psychological tests, and they all seemed to be psychologically healthy, too. This was the healthiest group of fighting personnel would ever put into the field in a war theater. The healthiest in all the history of our country. And this, I think, befuddles our government and the public, because how could such a healthy group fighting such a relatively benign war that lasted so short a period of time get and stay so sick? People don't understand it. And it made them initially not want to listen to those who were saying that they were sick. And it made them resort to psychological answers, because nobody understands psychology, really. And it's, if you can't understand a situation, you resort to an answer which is in an area that nobody really understands. It isn't that psychology that we don't know a lot about it. We know a tremendous amount about it. But it is incorporeal. It's intangible. And so this is where this whole, I think, focus on post-traumatic stress syndrome came from. How does it affect the family members? Well, I can tell you that they get sick, too, with elements of the index patient's disease. There is, in my view, transmissibility of this illness. It's not, you know, like smallpox. I mean, I don't think we're going to have a huge immediate pandemic of Gulf War illness. But insidiously, the people who are around Gulf War veterans for long periods of time, unless they take very good precautions, are getting sick. They are getting sick with very similar symptoms. Even some of the investigators are becoming ill. And they are developing in their blood similar viruses, similar funguses, similar changes in their immune system. You can see it. They're developing similar symptoms, etc. There seems to be some vector which is transmitting in a in some cases the illness from the Gulf War veteran to those around them. And this is not to panic anybody, but it certainly is something that's a concern.
Well, it is if you consider that the, let's say, just say for argument's sake, that the average size family is four individuals, a husband, wife, and two children, 700,000 people served. So now you got 700,000 times four, you're 2.8 million. Anything that infects one person could exponentially affect everyone that that person was in regular contact with. Now you start seeing the phenomena of doctors, nurses, caseworkers, and others who would be more intimately involved because they're there counseling and checking and examining. So we have the potential here to have an awful lot of people infected, and until someone recognizes that this is something that is spreading within the immediate family, then that's just only going to continue to increase, and that's not going to help anyone.
No, that's not going to help anybody. From what you're saying, we may be seeing a gradual kind of spread through the population of these signs and symptoms that is very debilitating, and that will make people unemployable and ill, unable to function, and can even affect their personal lives, because it affects your moods, it affects your ability to relate. The parts of the brain which are responsible for human relationships, called, you know, affiliative parts of the brain, the deep parts of the brain where, you know, we love, we bond, we attach, those parts are affected by this disease. They can be, in my view, damaged, and they can be very much affected in a long-term, very negative way, which you often ends up with the relationship falling apart.
Where are you at now in your own research to come up with some answers that might be able to turn some of this around?
Well, I am working with the government, as you mentioned, putting together a report based on an evaluation of Gulf War veterans, not in terms of treatment, but simply in terms of trying to understand what I and some of my colleagues who looked at them very, very, very carefully have come up with, the findings that we've come up with. And I'm in the process of finishing up a report, waiting for some of my colleagues to finish their part, and writing it up, and trying to get it into the proper agency of the government so that we can get going on a broader program, hopefully, of evaluation on really almost a microscopic level. You have to get that specific, and you have to get that how should I say, focused, that you really are looking far, far deeper than the normal physical examination, and you have to know a tremendous amount about immunology, about normal and abnormal physiology, especially metabolism, and the kind of metabolism that is normal and abnormal in human tissues. You also have to know a great deal about the nerves that are associated with the face, especially the senses like the vision and hearing and speech and breathing and movement. All these things are affected, and you have to have a very keen sense of what's abnormal about these people in this particular population.
Well, I certainly appreciate the work you're doing, and it's more than a ray of hope for all those Gulf War vets and their families. I want to thank you very much, Dr. William Baumswager, for being on and sharing your thoughts with us today.
Sure.
Now, let's go over, and let me just highlight this again before we go to our next guest who's standing by here. Here's what he had to say, just to summarize it all. Here is a board-certified neurologist and psychiatrist who has a background in neurotoxicology and neurophysiology. He's called in by the Army Surgeon General's office. They say, help us. All right? He's also working with the Armed Forces Physicians and the National Academy of Science, National Gulf War Vet Resource Center. He's their main person. He's out there trying to find what makes sense on this condition. And to do so, first off, he does a full and complete examination, and he finds that all of the other committees, the White House committee, especially the Clinton whitewash, that was just history, and the Gulf War vets should judge that as one of the dark days of just down and dirty co-opted politics, because nothing about that was honest. From beginning to end, that fix was on. They came away, and I've spoken with so many vets, saying that it's all in their mind. They're all suffering, no matter what conditions were presented. I was there filming the day in one of the committee hearings when one of the vets who had incredible lesions all over their skin, and it looked like, a thousand bumblebee stings. And this was a very severe rash, but it wasn't a rash like a herpes rash. It wasn't, a shingles. No, it was different. It was of unknown origin. Person had an immune system that was tanked out, had the blood work up to prove it, had severe problems with the liver, severe problems with mood, vision was going, and night sweats. And this is a guy in his late 20s. And they didn't care. They had their mind made up. Post-traumatic stress disorder stamp. Next person. A woman comes in who is suffering from the same symptoms that her husband, who served in the Gulf, she didn't. And now their children are suffering. Neurological problems. Stamp it. Post-traumatic stress disorder. And when you see this, you just become, you become so disheartened if you're a vet. Because you think, surely the government couldn't do this to its own. Surely there must be some way that the media would expose it. But no, the New York Times. Right. First call from the White House, they're going to bend over and kiss their butt. They did nothing. Disgrace of their shoddy reporting, the fear that they have. Not even fear. Let's assume that they knew exactly what they were reporting. Report the official position. And they did. Didn't challenge it. Didn't do an investigative report of their own. Why is it that the best investigative reporters in America have nothing to do with the mainstream media? Nothing. You get more information out of Covert Action Quarterly than the New York Times, New York Post, Los Angeles Times, Nightline put together. They don't even equal a blip in integrity and authenticity of reporting compared to Covert Action Quarterly. But be that as it may, I'm watching this and I film it. But then there was no doctor who said, well, what's what? Now there is. Now let's see if these very same insiders, the people that you always see on the other end of every slick willy handshake, these guys are as slick as eels going through Vaseline. They always come out with money, prestige, power. Nothing ever happens to them. Let's see if this time around on these National Academy of Science packed, you know, whitewash committees. That's what they should call all these committees, by the way. A blue ribbon whitewash. No matter what it is, no matter what facts, we'll not be confused by facts and evidence. We've got our special interest protective modus operandi and gear. That's what it is. Be honest. God, we can never be honest about anything in our society. We're such pathological liars about everything. It was a total whitewash, a sham from beginning to end. And who was up there protecting the vets? A few courageous legislators. Congressman Shays from Connecticut, good for him. Jay Rockefeller from West Virginia, good for him. Who else? Ted Kennedy. All right. And then you start to have to think, who else? And then the who else gets real thin. A few more. You'd have thought the entire Congress would have held Whitewater-type hearings. We're going to push for that, by the way, as soon as my new documentary comes out on this. And we have a march on Washington, which we will in about 4 months now, or 5 months now. We're gonna make this an issue, and I'm going to keep it alive every so often. Just keep reminding people what kind of sham and corruption has gone on. Right at the top of that list of people should be brought in to testify under oath, Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf. In any case, this guy is saying, hey, I'm telling you, and I'm the point man, I'm telling you, these people are not suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. These are real neurological toxins, and they are contagious. Contagious. Well, what happens if you have 2.4 million people who have contagions, who then come into contact with just two other people, who then come into contact with two other people, who then come into contact with two other people? You're over 50 million people. So I just want to let you know that someone at some point had best get honest about this and stop protecting the military-industrial complex and the Fort Detrick secret experiments and all the bad policies of shipping Saddam Hussein, all of the munitions and missiles and banned by Geneva Convention. Banning and violating international law never has bothered us. We violate every international law there is. We just don't want anyone else to do it to us. But we weren't supposed to be either testing or distributing biological agents. And we were. Now, we didn't care as long as he was using on his Kurdish activists, wiping out whole villages, and as long as he used it on Iran, that was fine. Then he used it on all the other troops. That was not fine. Had to cover it up. So now we're seeing it. We're seeing the depleted uranium. We're seeing all these different toxins ending up in people's bodies. Various combinations will cause different conditions. A lot have died. So what do we do about it? Well, we wait for his report and hope that, as he said, his phone's tapped. When was the last time you heard a mainstream orthodox MD, neurologist, psychiatrist, appointed by the Army Surgeon General's office, come on the air and say, we just found a phone tap yesterday, a bug on my phone? Who bugged him? Gulf War vet? No. Next door neighbor? Don't think so. One of the agencies that may have something to lose if he goes forward, and then they have to finally open up and admit things that they were able to cover up for 11 years? Yeah, that's the probable scenario. At least they're working now on spin control, plausible deniability. How can we minimize the downside to ourselves for making all these wrong choices and compounding it by lying and covering it up? And in the interim, how are those families going to feel when all this finally comes out? Think there's going to be lawsuits? You bet. You bet. And a lot of people are not going to look so good or not be able to continue the position of having the control behind the scenes that they have. That's my take on what he had said, adding in my own subjective editorial. Let's go to another person. He has a story as well. Larry Perry, a retired petty officer, served in the Gulf War and is currently president of the Desert Storm Veterans of North Carolina. He's testified before Congress as an advocate for Gulf War veterans. Nice to have you with us today, Larry.
Well, thank you, Gary. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Larry, I never like any guest to come on the show after I've done my own subjective editorial without them having a chance to challenge it or respond, so I'll give you that opportunity before I have our interview.
Oh, thank you. I agree with everything you say. It has been nothing but a whitewash since the beginning, and the United States has, like I say, violated every treaty there was, and human rights for our military people, and that's mostly the problem, and they're still in denial of that.
Okay, in January of 91, during the Gulf War, when you were stationed in Saudi Arabia, there was a very unusual incident involving an explosion that occurred over your camp. Would you please describe what happened that morning?
It was January the 20th, about 3:30 in the morning, and it seemed like every time we had Scud launches, they were early in the morning hours. But this particular day, that there were two gigantic explosions. I mean, it knocked the guys out of the tents from the concussion. And we went to our bunkers. We went to Moffett Level 4, which is all of our gear. And we stayed in the bunkers about a half an hour, and then they called the all clear. Well, then we would come out of the bunker undressed, took our mock suits off. We come outside, and all of a sudden a mist started coming into the camp, a light rain, or a real fine rain, as heavy during a fog. And everybody was starting to, their skin was on fire, just their face, their arms, everything was exposed behind the neck. And they started ringing the alarms again and said, you know, go to Mach Level 4, this is not a drill. And we stayed down in the bunkers about an hour at that time, but guys were having trouble breathing. They were just slobbering all over themselves and couldn't get their face masks fit. And a lot of them had the red rashes and blisters the next morning. But anyway, the Saudi Arabian National Air Defense System was tested the next very same morning. And there was a rumor that there was an aircraft, in the Iraqi aircraft, in the area with a spray outfit. And they had shot it down, was the explosions. But the next morning, they tested the air defense system. And then later that day, or it was the following morning, we were given direct orders to say that nothing happened. There was not a thing happened. There was no plane shot down. There was no toxic or no positive exposures. So that's kind of, it's been that way ever since. It's now when the Department of Defense does the incident reporting, it's now back to a sonic boom, which there's no sonic boom that has fireballs in the sky. That just don't happen. Don't make fireballs. And there was an explosion that night, and it's been turned back into a sonic boom as of today.
So the fix is back in.
The fix is back in. They've covered up everything. When the DOD had the call in, if you knew of an incident that happened, of chemical, biological related incident, you had an 800 number to call. And all that was is an information gathering system. There was, they gathered the information, they went and covered it up. That's all it was, is find out who knew what, and they went and fixed it.
Over the next few days and weeks, how many of your men became ill?
Quite a few. Matter of fact, I had to go to the hospital. I had, they classified as walking pneumonia, but I couldn't breathe. I was tightness in my chest, dizzy spell, just lightheaded, and extremely tired. It's fatigued. And a lot of them, they were medevacing out that was having heart attack-like symptoms. And Fleet Hospital 15, which was stationed in Al-Jabal, in the 74 days they were in Al-Jabal, just one hospital unit treated almost 9,000 patients. And they said that there was no significant, in other words, no, everybody didn't drop dead, so nothing happened. But they did have 9,000 sick calls for just one medical unit. So there was something significant happened that night.
But in official parlance, if they don't want anything to happen, they officially don't make it happen.
Right. Well, see, the person that sent the 8,000 sick calls back to the U.S., they didn't show up. They lost them. All the records were missing.
All of them?
Mm-hmm.
Some filing system, right?
Yeah, they showed up in file 13.
You realize that would be obstruction of justice if you or I did that?
Oh, we'd be, yes, absolutely.
As the president of the Gulf Desert Storm Veterans, have you heard similar stories from soldiers who were stationed in other areas during the Gulf?
All over the Gulf. This Camisea incident where they blew up the chemical weapons or their munition stockpile. And they said the DOD finally, after 8 years, admitted that it was chemical and biological weapons in those munitions depots. There were some 60 Camisea places. Iraq didn't have every bit of their ammunition in one place, and they were blown up all over Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. But they were blown up everywhere. And when, And a lot of people don't know this, but during the first 3 days of the air war, there were 4 nuclear facilities destroyed. And imagine somebody shot, you know, blowed up a nuclear power plant in the United States. They would have every EPA, every federal government down on them, and nothing happened over there. It was never mentioned.
Larry, after the Gulf War from 1991 to 1993,
mm-hmm.
you went public many times trying to get treatment for the soldiers.
Yes, sir.
Your pleas did end up in some newspapers more than once.
Mm-hmm.
How did the Army respond to you when you got that attention from the media?
Well, I was in the Navy Seabees.
Sorry.
To make it correct. My men, I called up 55 of my men and sent them over there. I sent them from my unit. I called them up and told them they'd gone to the Gulf. All right, they shows up. They come back, and they're sick as I am. We're all sick as dogs. They couldn't even drill. They were unable to pass their physical PT test. They was unable to pass their medical exam. And the reserve center would not, you know, they didn't want to hear it. The VA said, you know, we're not going to treat you because you're not responsible to the VA. The DOD says, we're not going to treat you either because you're not, you know, active duty. So we didn't have anywhere to go. The VAs wouldn't even let them in the door. So I went public and told them we were gassed in the Gulf. And that first time, that's when it went nationwide. And I got in all kinds of trouble. As a matter of fact, they relieved me of my command of my unit. They made me drill off weekends, so I could not talk to my men. And then when I did come on the right weekend, they put me on report and put me on restriction to the chief's quarters. I wasn't allowed to talk to the men again, and then discharged from the Navy.
Larry, after the Gulf War, you were totally disabled since the day you returned from the Gulf, as have thousands of other Gulf War veterans. Still, it's hard to find evidence of this in the mainstream media. One reason is that there is not one umbrella organization under which the veterans are united, although there are many smaller organizations and networks around the country doing a good job. But an even more important reason is what looks like propaganda on the part of the Department of Defense. When I began my series on Gulf War Syndrome, one of the first things I did was an internet search on Gulf War Syndrome, and the first site my computer located was a site put up by the Department of Defense, claiming to be working hard on the part of the Gulf War veterans and compensating sufferers of Gulf War Syndrome. What is the reality behind the compensation that the Department of Defense says it's imparting to veterans?
They have the compensation down pat. They are turning down 75% of the claims under the undiagnosed illness law. What happened here is when we first started complaining in 91-92, see, the Congress and the DOD and the VA says we don't have a law to compensate these veterans. Well, it took 2 years in Congress to pass the undiagnosed illness law, which was passed on November 1994. Well, then there's a catch-22, and it was to compensate veterans for undiagnosed illness. Well, say you had neurological problems, and it was due to anything, but you had a diagnosis, say bronchitis. Well, they can't compensate you for bronchitis for a diagnosed illness because you got a diagnosis. And those folks that had real undiagnosed illness, when they received a diagnosis, their compensation stopped. And that was wrong. It's still wrong. They're still doing it all wrong today. They should say that the veteran has bronchitis due to an unknown cause, not due to an unknown illness. See, they just got the wording wrong. And it's a word game now, and that's what it's been. And it appears to sound good. The DOD makes it, like you said, propaganda. Say they're doing everything they can to help these veterans, but they're literally doing nothing but fighting against us.
Now, the President of the United States has the power with executive order to make something happen. He can demand something, and he can use his influence. What was Clinton's response to all this? Oh, we got disconnected there. We'll, for whatever reason, we'll get him right back on the line and continue. By the way, these, I have about seven more programs over the next 7 months that I'm going to be doing, probably one per month, just to keep their voices alive. These are people that the public generally has not heard from, and I believe that we should be hearing from them. So let's go back and see if I can get Larry back on the phone, and we'll continue with our discussion. Larry, sorry, we just got disconnected there for some reason. All right, hold on. All right, let's go back to Larry, right? All right, please continue, Larry.
Yes, that was convenient, wasn't it? Where were we?
I was asking about Clinton could have, mm-hmm. by executive order, done more to have helped the Gulf vets to put together a committee that he knew was not stacked, and to have made some mandates, and it wasn't done. I was very disappointed in his actions.
Okay, you refer to the Redmond Committee, which was very stacked.
Yes.
And they got the answers they wanted, even though they did not review the proper literature. And that's what they've been doing all along, same with the PAC Committee, the Presidential Advisory Committee. All these committees are doing this. What the veterans need is private research funded by the DOD and the VA, and unbiased. In other words, when you take and ask the government to investigate themselves, they're going to come up with the answers they want. But we need this thing to be done by private scientists and researchers to get the answers.
Well, Garth Nicholson did some research. Are you familiar with Garth's results?
Yes, I have the mycoplasma also.
Why don't you explain to the audience what the Nicholsons found in the blood and the antibody activity of the mycoplasm incognitus?
Right. I was actually tested for that. There's four tests. I only tested positive on one, which is mycoplasma hominis, which is even rare. It's just rare also. But it's being found in most of all the sick veterans. And the treatment is the doxycycline, which can take up to a year to have any effect. And I've only been on it since September, so it hasn't helped me yet. But I'm still hoping that it will.
Just so people understand, Dr. Nicholson, who was for many, many years one of the lead cancer researchers at MD Anderson in Texas, Houston, was his daughter had Gulf War syndrome, served in the Gulf, and he started to do some research. And what he found was a very unusual mycoplasm. And this mycoplasm can cause gross immune deficiency, it can cause upper respiratory tract's acute distress, can lead to pneumonia. But when he studied the actual structure, he found that it was not a natural mycoplasma. To the contrary, it was one that had been genetically engineered. Now, that set off a whole series of alarms. And interesting, up till that point, Dr. Nicholson was an insider's insider. He was very respected within the scientific community, had published over 500 scientific articles in peer-reviewed journals, recipient of many mainstream research grants, full professor specializing in immunology and cancer. And now, like everyone else who has found something that the official physician didn't want to acknowledge, he began to be attacked. But he continued. Instead of pulling back, he went forward. And he found when contacting scientists in other countries that had also been involved in the Gulf conflict, that they also were finding the antibodies to this mycoplasma incognitus. And the incognitus was that it's a stealth microbe. It's not meant to be easily discovered. And it was genetically engineered to depress the immune system. Now, what would be the motive? Let's just hypothesize for a moment. Well, first, has there been any history, any evidence that the Armed Forces, Department of Defense, have ever used military conflicts as testing grounds for heretofore secret weapons of mass destruction, covert weapons? And the answer is yes. So voluminous is the material, it couldn't even fill 20 textbooks. in just one single announcement of one single set of experiments, just a few years ago, in fact, the Department of Defense stated that they had over 1,900 experiments just in exposing individuals to varying degrees of radiation to see what would happen. And when you get the actual studies and you read them and you see that this was not just a few bureaucrats making this up, it took physicians and hospitals and all kinds of people, thousands upon thousands of people, to cooperate with them. And just one of those studies, you could have exposed an entire community or a whole battalion. And that was just one. Now, there are many others that have been done. So, yes, service personnel, prisoners, and poor individuals, both in America and in other countries, generally someplace like Haiti, are frequently used to test all forms of experimental biologicals, including vaccines. This all also came out in the first hearings that were actually open on the subject, Senator Church. After that, he was under chronic attack because of his exposure of the CIA's operations around the world and how they had intentionally used the Africans in, at that time it was the Belgian Congo, to different types of vaccines and warfare agents, even polluting their waters to see what would happen, without, of course, notifying them, or without ever doing any follow-up to see what the ultimate consequence of this ecologically and human sacrifice might be. So on the one hand, we have a military that's been all too prone to use anyone that it felt was exposable to test its agents. And there's a whole mindset, a whole culture within the military, one that sees its goal completely limited to get this agent tested, get it created, get it out, but don't let anyone know about it, and have the mechanism for denying it. And that's what they've done. That's just on one hand. So at least we have the motive. And then, of course, they had the means. The means was vaccination. Because one of the things that turned up was that there were over 70,000 inoculation records that mysteriously disappeared. And as so many of the things mysteriously disappeared that were requested, no one did any follow-up. No one made anyone responsible. They just said it didn't happen. Or that there were no agents put into their bodies except the botulism and anthrax. But that was a lie. There was something else, an adjuvant, squalene. The professor who discovered this, purely by accident, and found antibodies in specific Gulf War vets that were suffering extremely debilitating conditions, she started to get death threats. When I interviewed her, I had to interview under conditions where her phone couldn't be tapped, and there couldn't be any record on my phone logs that I'd called her. You had no idea what we had to go through just to get her interviewed. She was terrified for her life because she said, these guys, meaning people in federal agencies, they play rough. They think nothing about killing people. But she had facts. Those facts have now been independently corroborated by multiple groups. So yes, there was an experimental adjuvant, squalene, in those vets' bodies. And those are the vets that got the sickest. In fact, some got so sick that they were having Gulf War syndrome before even they went over to the Gulf. And that was just one single area. Also, documents currently reveal that they knew, the Department of Army knew, that depleted uranium was very highly toxic. And yet they had our vets over there driving around these stupid tanks that were made of depleted uranium. You imagine what it's like to be living in an X-ray machine that's going off every millisecond? Those vets are frequently very sick. And every time one of those bullets exploded, made from the depleted uranium, those particles went in the air and drifted around. People breathed them in. It lodges in the lung. It's like a little X-ray going off in your lungs for 1,000 years. So when Nicholson came up with his research, it showed there had been an intentional and hidden experiment trying to create a microbe, perfect place to test it in this little war, that would depress people's immune system because someone, possibly one of the characters out of a Dr. Strangelove novel, thought, well, this is one way to defeat an army in the future. The trouble is, it was used on our army. Larry, your comments.
Yes. I believe the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the United States Army holds a patent on Mycoplasma incognitos.
I have not researched that. I don't know.
I think they do. They actually invented it. And I had another comment here, sort of a closure thing. But for your audience there, all 14,000 chemical alarms were false, declared by the DOD. And you just don't have that. We didn't have 14,000 false alarms. Also, we had 16,000 dead animals in the desert. Many died in herd formation, and they said they died of natural causes. And the Fox chemical detection machines that they had, the vehicles, Fox chemical detecting vehicles, after the DOD got done with their investigations, they were reduced to a pile of junk. They were worthless. And USCOM, the inspectors, actually found 13,155 millimeter artillery shells loaded with mustard gas. There were 6,200 rockets loaded with nerve agent. There were 800 nerve agent aerial bombs still found by USCOM. And they had 28 Scud missiles still loaded with sarin agent. And the 315 tons of depleted uranium dust left on equipment and on the battlefield. And just to tell you how toxic this battlefield was, when the dead bodies, the American dead bodies, come back to Dover Air Force Base in Dover, Delaware, 16 of the 17 morticians receiving the bodies have already died. In other words, they just caught what these soldiers had on them, and 16 of 17 have died. So, and there was anthrax detected outside of KKMC during the Gulf War. And all this has been covered up by our government and said it didn't happen. And there was there's no evidence of either chemical biological warfare was deployed or used at any level.
Well, Larry, that's what they say today.
Right.
But we're going to keep this issue alive and see if we can't change that tune on another day. Thank you very much for being on today, Larry.
You're welcome.
Larry Perry, retired Chief Petty Officer, serving the Gulf. I'm Gary Nall. This is a continuation of our series on Gulf War Syndrome, A Deadly Legacy, show number 2750. Have a good day, and we will continue broadcasting on this topic. By the way, this Sunday evening, just make a note of it, I'm on WNEW 102.7 from 8 to 9. Then I'm on WEVD 1050 AM from 9 to 10. So I'm on 2 hours. But NEW from 8 to 9, EVD 9 to 10. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a good day.